On peut que le temps trop carte qu'il y a hena à kewash à kenawo qui est tacha, on cache la contrinka, la crota ou choch un taku ou choch un yanka hechi, le na heche un yechi loste na un yechi loakham, heche jonk hena à ke un kit hoka va hiagle ki han heche, ou chon un chagua maniki, na ou chon un chagua a uki, le na hecha heche geluha, trokata oyate piktacha, na tioshpa piktacha, eche trunkashila lena wash akeki, nie luhaki heun lena icheuni chiapi. Oyunka ioko ki heel heche, wichokuze eache. Asni pijashni heche, ikchewichasha oyate mitakwe, koyag manik unhena wozani inushin ala pikte, na hena wichozani uchak uktonka heche, hena opkapie ha heche, wonian kilena luhanske, na cha oegle kilena awan chaitilake, heche tonka ohunkeshniki, na wakhenja kilena heche trokata oyate piktonka hel, woachwala na wolakhota, na wounspea yankeki heche ikchewichasha, Kavon spewa heche iotanla. Na iya pikile iotanla ktacha tunkashilo kantrinkale na woki. Ona skashitu kavon spewa tokums e yankayu kha heche. Tuktewa jichayu ha trokata ilagi cha pikta heche. Hena heche iunsia laptacha. Unkashilo kantrinka e ale na ichechi chi. Una heche tratuye e anuyak upi tratuye kele na tokums e heche yanke. Oyun khat khatu ek de na washte ki na ot khalo hena ekte hena el ta kuni ohun kishni wa khenjo i chanti ya prap kishni kha eche wo pila unkeni cha pi ta ku washte un yak upi kele na el eche wana ke o makho ekta un hena shi pon kha eta trokata ki atokum se washte na ot khala kta hechi hena un upi e ekti trokashi la hoechi che no shi un kila pi homenta ko yasin
Oh, that was Richard Brokennose. This is the Tushunka Witko Brigade. And we're live and direct here at Troll Radio 89.5 here in the soggy Olympic Peninsula Nisqually Basin area. Today's show we have, that we'll be talking to Ruth Talon, who is with, has lived many years in Ireland and has worked with the Irish Republican Freedom Effort over there. She has quite an extensive background. And we have some music associated with that that we'd like to play for you while I'm trying to make the connection here. I first met her in 1976 up in Vancouver when we all met up there to see if we could help with the Leonard Peltier first effort to seek political asylum. Hopefully a Caucasian-based country would be among the first ever in its history to grant a political asylum for an indigenous person who had actually taken up arms against its occupation and its militarism and violence and so on and so forth. Invasion, if you will. And true to form, the Canadian government did not break ranks with its racist history and did not grant Leonard Peltier political asylum, although there was ample evidence. There was all manner of testimony and reactionaryism from the Vancouver City Police that had depicted the scenes out of Pine Ridge, both during Wounded Knee and post Wounded Knee, with the escalation during the occupation. And to bring that point home quickly to you, that is the same thing that's happening in the Middle East with Iraq right now. The militarism was declared over with, and people got hung up on the idea that it was declared over with. But the real tragedy was about to unfold, and that's the total destruction of a society, its fabric, its reason for being, was then the undertaking of the colonial power, to the point and to the extent that nothing that even remotely resembles what was there before would stand on its own. And so therefore we have the complete gutting, the complete dismantling, the disassembly of a whole civilization occurring in Iraq right now, and about to occur in Iran, and about to jump off into South America with the people in that part of the world electing indigenous leadership. We are about to see a major confrontation between these colonialists, imperialists, the real outsiders and the real aliens, and their idea of civilization is being challenged, but nowhere is it more visible in terms of its effects than in Iraq, in which we see every day the evidence of what this kind of system really is, regardless of what they say and regardless of who they have saying it. And so hopefully the show that we're going to have today will be inspiring to you. The Tishinka Witko Brigade is an indigenous program, but it has its roots in many different areas in terms of ethnicities and cultures and so on. And Ruth is one of those people that we had made friends with a long, long time ago. And she has maintained contact. She will talk about her experiences. And that goes back to the days, you know, when they had the Bobby Sands case, you know. Leonard Peltier has been linked with such distinguished individuals who have stood for freedom, real freedom, not the George Bush idea of freedom or the Condoleezza Rice idea of democracy, or what passes on a daily basis here in this country as some sort of independent, free will, choice-based culture. None of that. All of that is the smokescreen, and all of the arguments that we are hearing and getting caught up for the people that are really politically astute are also the mind game. The idea that we can complain about what is the shortcoming of a society, of a system that is designed, that designs itself to create these shortcomings so that you will get caught up on it, and so you will not keep your eyes on the prize, and so you will miss the focus. And while they're doing that with you, they're also flanking you and maneuvering, and while they're doing that there, then they're also over here setting up the stage for the schools and so on, you know, anesthetizing the mental ability of our next generation. And while they're doing that there, then they're attacking people in, you know, this part of the country, you know, that part of the world. And while they're doing that there, then they're up here training the troops up here. And then while they're doing that there, they're recruiting your children out there. And while they're doing that, then they're also robbing you from financially with all their ideas and the credit and all that stuff. And while they're doing that there, then they're hip-hopping you into commercializing yourselves to ridiculousness, and, you know, and so it goes on and on and on. It never ends. It's an insidious program, but hey folks, it's effective. It works for them. And what works for us? Poverty. Is that working for you? Yeah, it's working out there, because there are people who are poverty stricken. That's the end result of a program designed to keep you from making any kind of a decent living. Whether you're in this country or some other country, the top 1% always parties. They are always in at the party. They are always clicking their wine glasses. They're always toasting themselves. They're always having their fashion shows. They always see their, you know, their pinup people, their beautiful people, you know, parading around. You always hear about their stories. You always hear about our people wanting to be like those people. You know, it. That's another part of it. So, you know, the whole idea of the insanity, you know, being the idea that you keep doing the same thing and you expect a different outcome. Well, we're all that and a bag of chips because we've been trying to do this, all of us, you know, for so long. We expect a different outcome. You know, that's the argument from within the system. Now, the other argument is to attack this system and to militarize and to, you know, ratchet it up a couple notches and to go the violent route. Well, that doesn't get you anywhere either because that's where they live. These are the people that are dismantling a whole society and doing it on your watch with your permission right in front of you on a daily basis, and you ain't done nothing about it so far. I mean, in a real sense, we haven't done anything about it. And they're getting ready to have another election here, and they're going to elect, you know, this individual's brother or somebody that's like that. So when we talk about real keeping your eyes on the prize political organization, we're not talking about what you see around you here. We're talking about a whole program of a vertical program. Because, and I can't even use the word revolution because revolution may not even be the adequate word here anymore. But let me play some music for you. This is Irish music for all you Irish people out there and all the supporters of Sinn Féin and Ireland in general. We support IRA. We're not into the Protestantism and all of that, but... let me run down to some of this music for you, and then we'll see if we can make connection with Ruth. Hope you enjoy.
By a lonely prison wall, I heard a young girl calling.
Michael, they are taking you away. For you stole Trevelyan's corn, so the young might see the moon. The prison ship lies waiting in the bay. So lonely around the fields of Athlone Rye.
By lonely prison wall, I heard a young man call. Against the famine and the crown, I rebelled, they ran me down. Now you must raise a child in dignity. Our love was on the wind.
so lonely around the fields of heaven high.
And this is a Tishinka Whitco Begay, and we have an interview with Ruth Tallon in Ireland. So, hello, Ruth.
Hello.
So, how's the weather there?
The weather here is cold and rainy and miserable, but that's what it's usually like in this time of year. But
well, it's good to have you. We would like to start at wherever you want to start with, and just sort of have a nice little chat here via intercontinental chat.
Okay. Well, maybe the first thing to start talking about is a couple of the environmental campaigns that are very significant here at the moment that people have started to organize around and which have caused a lot of anger here. One of them is the, I don't know if you're listeners would be aware, but the Hill of Tara is probably the most important archaeological, mystical, historical place in Ireland. It's the seat of the High Kings, and there's tombs and various other architectural or archaeological sites there that go back maybe to 2000 BC or even longer. It is the most important archaeological site in Ireland and possibly one of the most important in Europe. And the government has recently decided that they're going to build a four-lane highway through the valley. They say it won't affect the hill. A lot of scholars and historians and people who are expert in the field have publicly gone on record to say that it's a travesty to even think about building this road there. And in fact, it's 3 kilometers of road. Nobody's saying that a road isn't needed, but what they are saying is that there's another, two other routes that would be viable that it could go through. But we're into a situation here where, this country has been sort of inundated with tribunals of corruption and planning scandals and things, and the way they've sort of seemed to have got around this one is that they've passed a law which has allowed the minister to make a decision that the road is more important than the National Monuments Act, which protects all these sorts of sites here. So he's passed that law. There's a court case going on at the minute where the constitutionality of that is being challenged. But it is just unbelievable that in a place where history is so important, where tourism is even so important to the economy, trying to get commuters to Dublin because the whole sort of development of the country is completely skewed, so that everybody seems to end up having to go to Dublin to work, means that, you know, to get a few people on the commuter trail quicker, they're prepared to devastate a valley where even the government's own archaeologists have said there's at least 38 sites that they're going to actually disrupt going through that area. So that sort of ties together then with another planning scandal, which I don't know, again, you might have heard about Shell Oil and some other oil companies in a consortium have been trying to build a gas pipeline which will bring offshore gas into County Mayo on the west coast. People there organized against that and picketed so that the pipeline couldn't be built. They then took out an injunction, and five local people, three of whom have land that would be confiscated to build the pipeline, but people who live quite close to the area, anyway, five local men were in jail last autumn for 94 days before Shell Oil finally got the injunction lifted on them, but they were there for contempt of court because they were trying to stop this pipeline. And again, the government party that's in at the moment sort of fast-tracked that through the planning process. Originally, it was turned down for environmental reasons, and then they made representations to the government, and the Prime Minister intervened, and they got planning permission. And we have an organization here called the Centre for Public Inquiry, which is an independent investigative body, really. They did a report which called in an expert from America who knows about gas pipelines. He compared it to one you have there in New Mexico that burst in around about 2000, I think, said a very similar scenario, even though people there that were killed, I think there were 12 people killed in New Mexico when this pipeline exploded. And they were 206 meters away from the pipeline. People here live 70 meters from where they're proposing to build this high-pressure pipeline. So he's predicting, you know, that a similar sort of disaster could happen here. But what's happened is that for that and probably a number of other reasons, the chief executive of the center who did the report has been witch-hunted in the press, accused of all sorts of things like going to Colombia with a member of the IRA. Their money, which was the center was funded by an American philanthropist called Chuck Feeney, who has funded all sorts of education institutions here. The government intervened and got the American philanthropist to withdraw the funding for the center. So, I mean, it is really scandalous what's been going on in the sense of that, you know, these sort of planning travesties can go ahead, but on the other hand, it has been quite heartening that people have actually organized around these things and objected to them, and so far neither one of them have actually, at the moment there's now another safety report being conducted by a company that the government has been required to pull in to do another health and safety check. And we're still sort of waiting to see what the upshot of all that will be. But it seems to be that you attack the people who are coming up with the expert reports rather than the sort of drive to develop for some people to make more money.
Yeah, while you were speaking, I was reminded of the many times that the same scenario developed over here with the indigenous people, and the developers always seem to go after the most sacred sites. Like right now, as that is going on in Ireland, there's a similar effort again to put up a development right next to Bear Butte, which is sacred to about 30 or 40 different tribal nations in the Midwest. It's in South Dakota, right in the western part. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, this developer has these other sites, and every one of them are located around somebody, around a sacred symbol of some kind. And so, I was wondering if you care to comment on the significance of how is it that these developers, who may or may not be connected to intelligence, but maybe receive it, are always developing on some culture's most prestigious, most sacred site as some kind of a policy.
Well, I don't know whether I would. I mean, maybe you're right, and it is a conspiracy, but it's to me, it's just that they just have so little awareness, so little concern, and presumably there's a reason that the sacred sites are where they were, because of whatever was there, minerals or its location strategic, like the Hill of Tara is in the absolute center of Ireland. It's, you know, a high point where you can see for miles around. It's, you know, it's had a significance for lots of reasons, and has been, you know, over the generations been sort of taken over from the original religions and sort of made into a Christian site at one point to sort of appropriate it, I suppose. But I think it is just that drive for power and profit at any cost. And we're in a time when, you know, that is the dominant concern. And people are prepared to sort of almost accept anything if they see it in the name of modernization and development and short-term expediency, rather than sort of reflecting on, you know, how important heritage and landscape, even to people who don't sort of understand or see it as sacred in one sense, but how important it is to who people are and their whole sense of identity and what they are. But I think a lot of that, certainly here, has been lost in the rush to, you know, it's only in the last 20 years or so that Ireland has actually started to become a rich country. You know, 20 years ago we had a genuine debate about whether it was a third world country. And now it's certainly not that, although a quarter of the population still live in poverty here. But it's one of the richest countries in Europe. And it's got that way by just jettisoning a lot of the things that people have held dear in terms of their sense of their collectivity and who they are and what's important. You know?
Well, I know that in Iraq, for example, when they first went in, once they had established their presence, I mean the coalition of the willing forces, the first thing that they did was raid all the museums, and we're now the U.S. press media industry is now beginning to get reports of the effort it was that went into securing these priceless pieces of art and other archaeological finds that go back to the beginning of time that are now the targets and have become the targets. And then in this country we have native people who have been pretty much eradicated as a culture, but you can see in all the museums, you know, whether it's in the nation's capital or other museums, in Washington we have one of the big issues was the Kennewick man, where the scholars are arguing over this skull that was supposedly thousands of years old, and they were saying it was a Caucasian as opposed to an indigenous, and thereby the theory that they were posing was that Caucasian people were here before indigenous people, and on to absurdity. But the point is that all of the bones, as well as all the other things that humans make throughout thousands of years of living, can now be found at your local museum. The sum effect of that is a culture that basically does not exist anymore outside of a museum, and then now they have become mascots for the occupying culture. Do you see anything like that as a potential development?
Well, I suppose it's different in one sense, but I mean, people sort of create their sense of culture and it does change, but there is, I suppose, there are caricatures of Irishness as well, and I think people are sort of struggling to get a positive identity, but part of that has, and certainly with modernization or this drive to a type of modernization, people have thought, for instance, to get rid of the Irish language because they saw it as something that was backward and associated with poverty and peasants. Now, some of that has changed as people have made the language part of a resistance, and also, as maybe young people are getting a sense of pride or something, may have actually taken a new interest in the language. But you'd still have a big debate here around Irish about whether, it made more sense for young people to study some other European language because, Irish is just known in Ireland. And not recognizing that if people don't have Irish, they can't read their own histories. They can't know all about the things that happened here that were only written about by Irish scholars well before sort of you had it, at a time when the rest of Europe was in the Dark Ages, you had people here who were scholars. And all of that massive heritage will be lost if people don't actually preserve the language. And yet, you would still have a very, what's the word? A debate cast in the terms of modernity that would sort of say, just reject the language because it's pointless and useless and of no interest. Again, it's one of those things where luckily there are a lot of people for whom it is important, and they do recognize, how important it is to, not just to people who actually have the use of the language and are fluent in the language, but to what shapes people's sense of themselves and the collectivity of the society, and the values that are, always contested, I suppose, in any culture. There's always, these things aren't set in stone. There's always people who have different opinions in different cultures about what values should dominate. But there is something about that drive to, Americanize and to leave the past behind and just make money and become, property speculators and money traders and things. And to live well, but not to actually notice who's, at whose expense you're living well at,
Yeah, I know that feeling real well, being having watched it over 35 years. I wonder if you care to go back to the days of the original Indian Center up in Vancouver for a bit, just if you wanted to walk down.
Well, that's where we first met about 30 years ago. I was just working it out. Leonard Peltier, who I'm sure your listeners know much about, was in Canada on the run. And in February 1976, so it's almost exactly 30 years ago, a friend of mine in Vancouver got a phone call to say he had been arrested in Canada and was going to be in court in Vancouver the next morning. So we didn't actually know anything about Leonard at the time, but we're certainly sympathetic and were involved with some of supporting some of the blockades and the land claim struggle that was going on in British Columbia at the time. So we turned up in court, and that was really the beginning of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee and the campaign to stop the extradition of Leonard Peltier from Canada. And I think it's actually sort of important, thinking about this just in terms of this interview. It was a period, Leonard Peltier was in Canada in jail for a year before he was extradited. And yet that's sort of a period that has been sort of written out, I think, of the Leonard Peltier story and forgotten, maybe because a lot of the people who then took over the campaign once he got back to South Dakota didn't know what had happened in Canada. But I think for a whole lot of reasons, it was actually a really important period of time in Canadian politics, the Native American struggle in Canada, even sort of separating out and away from what happened around Leonard himself. I think that mobilization that took place, you know, where the Vancouver Indian Center, it's hard to describe and hard to imagine, but because that was where the Defense Committee was based, you had young Native people from all over the country, mostly from sort of Canada, people coming off reserves from the north and right across the country, homeless young people arriving and living in the center and getting involved in the campaign and not having any politics necessarily or an understanding of imperialism or any of those things. And yet that campaign, it was like Steve Biko. I sometimes think it was like that, the black consciousness thing in South Africa, where those young people, through being involved in that situation, actually were, some of them were transformed. And, you know, I left sort of shortly after Leonard was extradited to the States and came over here to Europe. But I often wonder whether, you know, how many of those young people that were involved that way actually then went on to get involved in the land claim struggles. And, you know, as you know, like, whatever the faults are, there was actually a lot of progress made in Canada in terms of, you know, Native people getting some political autonomy in the north, for instance. And I've often wondered just sort of, you know, where did all those young kids go and what did they do? And I don't think that experience could have been lost. You know, I don't think they all went back to not doing anything in their lives.
Yeah, the over the years, the stories have come trickling back to me, and you're right. The people do not know that part of the Leonard Peltier story and how it was, you know, the Indian Center became a beacon in Canada. And even down here in stateside, the movement, people do not understand exactly that whole era. Even Leonard doesn't know really what happened in terms of the politicization of some of the people in Canada. And when I talk about it and when I have talked about it, it's almost like there's no connection to that, because it's like a story from some other strange part of the galaxy or something.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose partly because it happened in Canada, and so, and it was a different set of people or whatever. So people didn't actually understand, first of all, sort of the impact it had on the Canadian sort of political situation. Or, I mean, I even, you know, and looking at it sort of an outsider, insider, but, like, there were really important, aside from the relationships in terms of the development of all the people who came in and got mobilized and got a sense of themselves and sense of a culture of resistance and all of that, like, even the relationships between, you know, the changes that were brought about by having the American Indian Movement people coming up from the States, whose political experience and cultural experience was very different because they'd had, you know, they'd been living in cities for a lot longer. They'd had the contact with the black movement and the Hispanic movement, just a very different kind of experience, and the Vietnam War and the anti-war movement and all of that. And then a lot of the people who were coming down to Vancouver from the reserves, because of the whole different way the two governments had handled the Native population, a lot of those people had been isolated on reserves, which meant that they had retained maybe more of their own cultures in some ways and their languages, but didn't have that kind of hard-edged political experience. So those two sort of forces came together and in some ways were important, because I know people felt that, you know, sort of some people from Canada actually maybe were closer to the land, still closer to their own traditions, had things to offer them. And so it was very much a sort of cross-fertilization, which, again, it's hard to know what the important, you know, how that played out. But to me, looking at it as a non-native person, it seemed to be a really important development, despite the fact that I suppose there were a lot of defeats before and afterwards in terms of where, you know, the way the movement got decimated, I suppose, in some ways, particularly in the States, sidetracked and all the things that happened. But I don't think those kinds of experiences, you know, are important individually to people, but they're also, there's some sort of critical mass there as well, which I still think must have had some impact on a whole load of situations that people would have found themselves in later.
Yeah, we also, I remember some of the highlights back in those days. One of them was that Annie Mae Aquash is a Canadian citizen, and we had, through this defense committee at the Indian Center, we had brought that up, and we had taken that and ran with it for a little while. I wonder if you care to comment on that part of it from what you can recall.
Well, I mean, I didn't know Anna Mae, and I remember at the time people being very shocked and stuff when they heard that her body had been found. At that stage, everybody understood that she had been lost in the custody of the FBI. Now I know that there's a lot of questions about what really happened to her, and I'm out of touch with what really happened to her. I think, you know, maybe the Canadian government should do more. It's hard for me because I'm so out of touch. I don't actually know the political scene there anymore. I know that the Canadian government maybe learned some lessons from the extradition of Peltier when it was finally proven that, in fact, the extradition happened on false affidavits being presented to the Canadian government. But whether they knew that, or some of them knew that at the time, or whether if they had known it would have made that much difference, because they probably didn't really want to take on the Canadian government or the American government over somebody who they would have seen as a threat anyway. I know there's been a lot of support in Canada from politicians and stuff since for Leonard, but it's hard to know. You know, at the time, a lot of appeals were being made to them, and they didn't move, and they didn't distance themselves from the American government. In retrospect, they're now offended because they did find out they were lied to. It's hard to know. But, like, I can remember when Myrtle Purbear, who made the false affidavits, or some of the false affidavits that were used, I can remember her coming to Vancouver in the protection of the American Indian Movement because she was afraid for her life and was sort of, you know, staying there where she could be safe for a while. And she was just a young, sad character, very, you know, mixed-up young woman. But she knew, I suppose, at that stage who her friends were, you know, who was actually going to protect her and care about what happened to her. But I'm not sure whether it was the Canadian government or the American government that would have, certainly not the American government.
Well, right now what's going on with that, just to highlight that, there's two gentlemen were arrested within the last few years and charged with the death of Annie Mae, and one of them is fighting extradition in much the same manner that Leonard fought extradition, and later on Dino Butler too, as it turns out, on some bizarre case that he was involved in, a car chase or something. But at any rate, this John Graham has surfaced as a political prisoner fighting extradition. He's out on bail, and in the first trial, which happened down here in the States, Arlo Looking Cloud was convicted in South Dakota. What's interesting to note was not that they were going to get a conviction, because it was just foregone conclusion that the U.S. was going to, this was a slam dunk case for them. But during the trial, John Trudell and Kamook Banks were witnesses for the government. And it was revealed later on that Kamook Banks had been an informer for the government, even all the way back when she was with Banks. So, and that goes all the way back to Wounded Knee. And then we find out later, after the Looking Cloud trial is concluded, that she was married to Bob Ecclefee, who was one of the head vigilante, what they call the goons, on the Pine Ridge, who is himself an FBI agent or U.S. Marshal, and that in the attendance of this wedding was a whole gaggle of FBI agents and so on. And then during the testimony itself, it was revealed that Kamook Banks, who goes by the name of Darlene Nichols, and now Ecclefee, received upwards of $40,000 from the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation. I wonder if you care to enlighten the audience about some of those issues, and then and maybe add if you want your thoughts.
Sorry, I missed the last bit of your sentence, Eric.
Well, just add your thoughts to that, and get some comments from you about how, within the movement, we have people that have, been uncovered as informers, and what that all may mean.
Well, as you know, I think we've just had a very similar situation here, where a man who had a long tradition and a long history had been in jail with Bobby Sands, was considered to be a very close friend of a number of people who'd been through the whole prison struggle here. And who was working for Sinn Féin as their head of administration in the Stormont Assembly. And he just before, a few days before Christmas, announced to the world that he'd been a British agent for 20 years, working for Special Branch and British Intelligence. So I suppose any political movement that is going to be in opposition to the powers that be are going to be subject to that kind of infiltration. It's always a shock when it's people that you think have a ideological commitment and a personal commitment. This man in Ireland, for instance, he was the way it sort of has come out over the last couple of years was he and his son-in-law and another man were arrested. And at the time, the scandal around their arrest, there was supposedly an IRA spy ring within the Stormont Parliament. That brought down the government that had been set up with the executive, with Sinn Féin in the executive. It was a big scandal at the time, and supposedly that was because of it. And now we find out that the man who is supposed to be at the center of that spy ring was actually a British agent. And the trial finally collapsed here. But that man subjected his son-in-law, his daughter, his grandchildren to 3 years of hell, aside from all his other political comrades. And for whatever reason, nobody can work out, except, it's hard to believe what somebody, what they could have done to somebody to make them turn. So, he must have had self-interest. He admitted he got paid. It's hard to conjure up what could make somebody do that. Unless they're actually in there originally sort of committed working for the other side. But, somebody comes out of a community, a group of people who you think you can trust, but I suppose it's just, you have to take these things in your stride and assume that it's going to be somebody and hope that it's not going to be somebody who you really trust. And, it's mind-boggling when you think about somebody like Kamook Banks, but, you know, then you don't know really where she started from, or at least I don't anymore. I mean, I remember John Graham. I didn't know him well, but he always struck me as a very spiritual person, a very quiet young man. So, you know, why it's him that has come to be put in this position, I don't know. There's an awful lot of questions from this side of the water I really can't answer, but I mean, I suppose the Black Panthers were decimated by informers. Every political movement seems to have them. And it can be devastating for those around them and the damage that they can do to people's lives.
Yeah, we've tried to include in some of our education that very concept of how a society that we find ourselves in, like the U.S. society, basically creates the atmosphere for which informing and you might even call these people that work within a society, a system, and seem to be legitimate because they were there at the beginning, almost the same equivalent to what the U.S. War on Terror calls sleeper cells. These are sleeper agents that their job is to get so vertically embedded within society's very fabric that they're like the Manchurian Candidate, you know, at some point, you know, they collect all this information. And when you start to look at it more than just how it makes you feel, but you start looking at it from other perspectives, like the perspective I've been looking at a lot of this is through the mental health perspective, since I've been working in that field for a number of years now. And I started getting some revelations that I had not seen when I was just sort of viewing this from just straight on political and sort of a confrontational perspective, that this society itself imbues its people to inform, to rat on each other, to snitch each other off, to, you know, do the most unconscionable things as a matter of training. I mean, they get this when they go to school, you know, that they're supposed to, they march the kids in when they're young, they put them in the principal's office. They split them up. The first thing they do is they start grilling one or the other, and they start with their punitive system. And after 12 years of that, and not to mention what you may get when you live, you know, outside of the school system, out in the community, creates a kind of a sort of an addicted mentality towards doing this. And so it's not surprising if they receive training on top of this, when you look at it from this one perspective, that they would actually go ahead and, you know, reveal the most trusted member of the group or one of them, like Doug Durham, for example, or Kamuk Banks or Ward Churchill, or, I mean, there's been a number of these people that have come up throughout the movement here. Doug Durham, for example, was Dennis Banks' bodyguard. Annie Mae herself has been targeted and may, in fact, be an informer. We don't know. Nobody knows. So that was my take on it.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose some people you don't know, and you'll never know. I think the only thing you can do is accept the fact that they're going to be there and try and instill values and try and do things in a way that, you know, can be damaged the least without getting paranoid or conspiratorial about it or whatever, to just stick, you know, to your path and sort of do what you think has to be done and is the right thing to do and to inculcate that and to try and break through. Maybe that sense of, you know, people are so, you know, even your sort of ordinary person is afraid to stand out and is afraid not to be part of the majority, you know, and people can be very passive unless they really maybe see their own self-interest threatened or something. And, you know, sometimes it can be disappointing when you want people to organize around something positive when actually they're the only concern with a quite narrow, private sphere of life. Sometimes you can get disappointed, and then other times people will surprise you by their generosity and their commitment and all of that. So, I mean, I suppose it is just to try and do things in a way that people can't damage if they do want to do the damage.
I was wondering if you'd care to...
A different sense of values and, you know, ideas about collective responsibility among people, instead of having everybody just think they have to look out for themselves and, you know, in the most short-term way of who's got the power, so who they should go along with, you know. I mean, which is slightly different than maybe people who make a conscious choice to set themselves out to be sort of on the other side or whatever.
A little while ago, you had mentioned a name, Bobby Sands. I was wondering if you could give the audience a little bit of history in case some of the people don't really know some of these people.
Yeah, I suppose we take it for granted that people, even people here now, this is coming up to the 25th anniversary of the hunger strike when Bobby Sands died. And we sort of take it for granted here that people know about that. And then you realize, of course, that lots of people weren't around 25 years ago and some of us... when some of us were. I mean, we have a, you know, a peace agreement, which is still not being properly implemented and is causing, that's causing us concern here now. But the roots, I suppose, of the agreement, which was now signed, it was signed in 1998, which is quite a long time ago now. We're coming up to 7 years or so from that. But the roots of that agreement go back, I suppose, to the hunger strike. And that was, you know, the probably the biggest political mobilization in this generation, or the last, I suppose, maybe it's now the last generation, in Ireland. You know, there was an armed conflict here, which only really ended over the last couple of years, despite the peace agreement. We finally... the IRA decided to decommission all its weapons not very long ago. People there may know Gerry Adams' name. He went on TV there before Christmas and said finally on television, to hopefully to the satisfaction of most people, that the war is over. So we're trying to sort of build, you know, in that scenario, build a different kind of society and to, you know, take a political way forward out of the armed conflict. But in 1980, we were still very much, you know, embroiled in armed conflict. There were a lot of prisoners, political prisoners. And I suppose, again, the difference between sort of situation here and Leonard Peltier's situation is that there was a long history here of political prisoners, that the prisoners who were there because of their you know, military activity because of the conflict, politically motivated prisoners, actually were recognized as political prisoners in the system here. And what had happened was the British government decided, as it does on a sort of regular basis, the political status had been won by prisoners going on hunger strike in the 70s, 1975, I think it was. Or 74. And then they decided again that they had to wage a campaign to recast those political prisoners as criminals, which meant taking away the status that they had. Let me just take a glass drink here.
You have 1 minute and 0 seconds remaining in your account.
We have 1 minute.
Hello? So do I need to just finish up?
Yep.
Right, well, I suppose just to say then the situation was the political campaign was won. The hunger strike, which killed 10 men, and a lot of people outside the prison involved in various things, they did win back a recognition and got their demands, and that actually laid the basis for moving forward the political situation in a political and electoral way forward, and that has transformed the situation here. But as I say, there are things that could be rolled back, but we are trying to construct a new sort of situation here on the basis of that hunger strike where Bobby Sands and nine of his other...
I think we've ran out of time here, so let me play a music, some music. This is from Ireland, and some music from the people over there. You're going to be listening to Bobby Sands.
Five simple things we ask of them. Five simple things denied. But Thatcher will not compromise. I ask my mother's permission to finally break her heart. We have come to a decision. Hunger strike. Three comrades starve behind me. I pray to God that my debt will lead to compromise. I can no longer see your face. My phone.